Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
For President Bush following his visit to India. During his short trip to Pakistan, Bush will meet with the country's president, Pervez Musharraf. The official welcome mat may be out, but in the streets of several Pakistani cities, even before Bush's arrival, anti-American protests erupted. Here's the view of one man in Islamabad.
We are against the coming of Bush here because we hate him, because he is the killer of so many innocent people, so many innocent Muslims. And whatever he has been doing, he was doing against the Muslims.
Crowds burned American flags and chanted death to Bush and scuffled with police. Although some protesters also greeted the president in India, the Pakistan trip poses many challenges for the White House. David Montero is covering the president's trip to Pakistan for the Christian Science Monitor, and he joins us from Islamabad. David, it looks like a rough welcome for President Bush.
Yeah, it's been a tense and stressful prelude, I think, to his trip between the protests and the suicide bomb attack in Karachi on Thursday.
How is that suicide bombing, which killed an American diplomat yesterday, how is that affecting the image of Pakistan and what's happening there among U.S. officials?
Well, I think it's definitely going to put more pressure on Musharraf to show that he's committed to fighting the war on terror. I think, obviously, Bush is going to be under more pressure to raise the U.S. administration's concerns about what Pakistan is doing against terrorism, with this bombing having killed American diplomat just days before he arrives.
And Pakistan President Pervez Musharraf will be discussing terrorism with President Bush. The president, just before coming to Pakistan, predicted again that Osama bin Laden would be caught and is expected to at least discuss that. I don't know about putting pressure on him, but discuss the issue of trying to find some of the militants believed to be in Pakistan. But at the same time, isn't Musharraf under pressure at home not to cooperate with the U.S.?
Naturally, any move he makes towards cooperating with the U.S. alienates a lot of people here who are upset about the U.S. war on terror. I mean, even moderates here would say most of us in Pakistan are moderate, but we just don't favor the war on terrorism because it translates to a war against killing our own people. And they point to the recent missile strike in Bajor Agency, where a CIA drone killed civilians, as an example of that. So, yeah, definitely there is going to be more pressure on Musharraf because of the U.S. war on terror.
And so then, is it realistic for the White House to make the predictions that it's been making about catching some of the top militants in the area, believed to be in the area?
Well, I mean, if the track record is any indication, I think it is a little unrealistic. The Pakistan military certainly shows its willingness and its ability to strike at militants when it wants to. For example, in recent days, 40 militants or 45 militants were killed by U.S.-Pakistani gunships and troops. But, you know, the leadership of Al-Qaeda and of the Taliban remains at large in this what is considered a rugged tribal zone on the Afghan border. And, you know, in the 5 years or 4 years of the war on terror, we haven't really seen too many of them captured.
I believe the discussions also with Musharraf will focus on more democratic reforms within Pakistan. Is that something else on the agenda during the president's visit?
Yeah, I mean, that's the hope that many people have. I mean, I think there is a fear that that may not materialize. I think people are afraid that the nuclear deal just signed in India is going to overshadow the very short visit that Bush is going to make here. But what people hope would come out of this visit is that, yes, President Bush would show that the U.S. administration wants and has a broader relationship that goes beyond just Musharraf and touches civilian institutions of power, civil society, and the opposition. But whether or not Bush is actually going to make an overture to show that that relationship exists beyond Musharraf remains to be seen. And I think in the time allotted for this trip, it seems that it would be largely impossible to do that.
You mentioned the nuclear agreement that the U.S. and India signed earlier this week during Bush's visit to India, and you said this is likely to overshadow the visit. What's been the reaction in Pakistan to this agreement?
There are people in Pakistan who would say, analysts and people in the administration, who would say, well, this is a deal that we deserve as well, when it's clear that the American administration is not going to offer Pakistan this kind of deal. But I think people are upset that something like this would be offered to India and not to Pakistan.
What would you say would be the most substantive thing that may come out of this visit to Pakistan?
The most significant thing that could come out of it, and again, I don't know if this will happen, is if there is, again, a gesture made towards recognizing that the United States' relationship with Pakistan is broader than the war on terror, and that it includes a relationship or a direct connection with civilian institutions that are outside of the purview of the Army.
All right. Well, David, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
David Montero is covering President Bush's trip to Pakistan for the Christian Science Monitor. Well, that nuclear deal that the president signed with India yesterday is already being criticized in Washington, D.C. Under the agreement, India will classify 14 of its 22 nuclear reactors for civilian use and will open them up to inspections by 2014. The remaining reactors will be for military use and will not be open to international inspections. The deal also removes a U.S. moratorium against selling nuclear fuel and parts to India, and that was put in place in 1974 after India first tested a nuclear bomb. Massachusetts Democratic Congressman Ed Markey is among those criticizing this agreement, and he joins us on the line from Washington. Congressman Markey, President Bush calls this an historic pact. How would you describe it?
I would agree with him. I think it's an historic failure that threatens the very survival of the nuclear nonproliferation regime. President Bush gave the store away, capitulating to every significant demand put forward by the Indian government to sign a bad nuclear deal that will undermine United States and international security. The United States gets nothing from this deal other than goodwill from India and the possibility of future nuclear contracts, but the reality is that the nuclear proliferation, non-proliferation regime for the world is now in tatters as Pakistan and Iran and North Korea look at this as an exception for one country that to a set of rules that they are going to be asked to abide by.
Specifically, which parts of the deal concern you?
Well, the president failed to insist that all of India's old used nuclear fuel be safeguarded against diversion to nuclear weapons. And it also failed to get India to agree to what the administration had actually characterized as its top negotiating objective, which was getting India to put all of its fast breeder reactors under safeguards. The administration has said that it will allow India to decide whether and when any fast breeder reactors come under safeguards. Those are the reactors which will actually create the nuclear bomb material. They will not be under safeguards. It is just a terrible deal.
So what do you think happened there? If that was the top negotiating point for the U.S., then why did it allow that to go through?
I don't believe that the president really does hold the nuclear nonproliferation regime in high regard. And now with this deal, what we're seeing is a signal being sent that the president is going to engage in bilateral nonproliferation in negotiations. But that is going to unravel and isolate us because ultimately what will happen is that China will turn to Pakistan and will say, we will now cut a similar deal with you that the United States cut with India. So I just think the president just sees the deal right in front of him and doesn't understand what the consequences are going to be in the years ahead.
Mm-hmm. When the White House says goodwill from India, and India is an important ally from Washington, an important counterweight to China, and possibly deserves special consideration, these are all claims from the White House here, what would you say to that?
I agree that India is a good friend of the United States. I agree that India deserves special consideration. But it should be special consideration in agricultural policy. It should be special consideration in technology policy and biotech policy. There are many, 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 many areas where we can cut special deals with India that is a manifestation of our friendship with them. But to take nuclear materials and to hold them out in violation of existing international law as a way of cementing our friendship with India will only result ultimately in destroying our ability to enforce a regime that we really need to have in place against countries that do threaten us. So the president just unfortunately succumbed to the temptation, which is understandable, to give this country the one thing that will trigger a cascading negative set of events in other countries in the world, beginning with the UN having Iran before the United Nations Security Council next week, trying to enforce the very same set of policies against them that we've now exempted India from having to abide by.
But is it really fair to compare India with Iran?
No, they're two different countries. But the reality is that if we expect Iran to live by the rules, then we have to apply them to everyone. We, the United States, can't break the rules for India and expect Iran to play by them. Pakistan is already insisting on equal treatment. If President Bush gives it to him, that's a disaster. If he says no to Pakistan, that's also going to be a disaster, because Pakistan will turn to China or to some other country and say, well, let's have a special relationship based around the transfer of nuclear technology as well. The entire system of domestic and international nuclear proliferation controls will begin to fall apart. So we don't need two separate systems, because you don't need a system for a friend which is unlikely to break the rules. You need the system in place for your enemies, off of the countries that you don't trust. And here, the president has begun the process of unraveling that set of safeguards.
This needs to be approved by Congress. So we've heard opposition from both sides of the aisle here. Do you think that you'll be able to prevent it from going through?
I think as members of Congress begin to see clearly what the ramifications are of carving out this massive loophole to the nuclear nonproliferation regime, that their misgivings will turn into a very significant opposition. We are about to have an historic debate in Congress over the next several months on approval of this agreement. It has to go through the House and the Senate, and I think that the people are going to understand how hard it will be for us to enforce the nuclear nonproliferation regime on other countries if we don't hold the line on India.
Congressman, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Representative Ed Markey is a Democratic congressman from Massachusetts. He joined us on the line from Washington, D.C. Just ahead, multinational pharmaceutical firms go to India for their drug trials. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now.
We welcome competition, but we won't fear the future either, because we intend to shape it through good policies. And that's how you deal with in a global economy. You don't retrench and pull back.
That's President Bush speaking today in Hyderabad, India, where many foreign films have set up shop, taking advantage of India's well-educated, English-speaking, and less expensive workforce. Outsourcing of American jobs overseas in India has been a hot topic in the U.S. Firms there handle everything from software engineering to customer service calls, and now drug trials. One analyst estimates that in the next 4 years, the outsourced drug trial market in India will hit $1.5 billion. This is much-needed revenue to often struggling Indian hospitals and free medications to those who are ill. But it can also result in vulnerable patients being turned into human guinea pigs. An article in the recent issue of Wired Magazine deals with this, and joining us on the line is Jennifer Kahn. She's contributing editor of Wired Magazine, and she reported this story. Jennifer, how common are these trials in India?
Well, they're really quite common. There's a large number of pharmaceutical companies that are based in India, of course, but there are also a lot of multinationals, GlaxoSmithKline and Pfizer and many others, that operate in India as well.
Why are these multinationals outsourcing their drug trials there?
Well, really, there are two reasons. One is that India has an extraordinary number of very well-trained doctors, all of whom are fluent in English and have fairly good facilities to work from. But there's also an extraordinarily large number of what the drug companies rather delicately call treatment-naive patients in India. And that means that they're patients who have never been given medical care or certainly have never been given drugs. And that's better for them. It produces cleaner trial results.
And why do they go along, the well-educated doctors and the patients?
The patients, as a rule, don't tend to be so well-educated. The ones, at least, that I interviewed are often out in a rural area. Many of them have, they've been to a doctor maybe twice in their life before, and they certainly have never been on medication. One gentleman I talked to, the drug trial was the first medication he'd ever taken. So they're not the ones that are so well informed. The doctors are well informed, and they see several benefits. One is that their patients get free medication, which is sometimes useful, depending on the drug. One is that their hospital, or they, depending on the situation, get money. The doctor I was speaking with, his hospital got $665 per patient that the hospital enrolled, the per stroke patient that they enrolled, which is quite a large sum, given that it's a little over what this man makes a month.
And how many patients, then, are we talking about?
Well, he signed up about a quarter of his stroke patients. In his case, he works in a very rural area, so it was not that many patients. But when you factor this over a very large country and have a large number of doctors recruiting, you can pull in a large number of patients.
Mm-hmm. And how are these trials regulated?
Well, that's a good question. In the country themselves, they're often not regulated as closely as they could be. The countries often just don't have the regulatory framework in place the way that other countries like the U.S. and Europe, in the U.S. and Europe, do. One of the better things about the multinationals is that they're, of course, very concerned with their global reputation, and so they actually do a somewhat better job of trying to make sure that they get decent doctors running decent trials. But that doesn't mean that there aren't still some problems.
And getting decent doctors to run decent trials, I mean, who basically makes sure that there's a standard adhered to? Anybody there?
Well, India does have a Drugs Controller General, which is the equivalent of the U.S. FDA. The problem is it's only staffed by a few people, which is far too few in a vast country to really go around and check in on trial sites, which is why most of the multinationals actually do site inspections themselves. They make sure that they at least try to drop in on some of the trial sites themselves to make sure that procedures are being obeyed. But as I said, of course, it's still quite hard to really know what's going for them to really know what's going on, whether patients are being signed up who really understand what they're getting into. A number of the patients I spoke with, certainly, in fact, all of them, none of them understood that they were participating in an experimental drug trial. They didn't really understand the concept that a drug might be experimental, that it might be being produced for profit, as opposed to being donated by the government or by the United States, which is what most of them thought.
And so then, because there's some ambiguity there, are these tests then, these trials, accepted when the drug is then more toward the end of the approval process?
Well, the trials are definitely accepted. I mean, there certainly are some issues. The pharmaceutical companies are, of course, very concerned about any problems that side effects, for instance, would be underreported. And that's a tricky thing to balance. They probably are, because these are patients who are they've learned not to question their doctors, and sometimes there's a problem of not wanting to offend the doctor by implying that the drug causes problems, that it's giving them a headache or something else.
One of the doctors that you interviewed, the doctor who gave this drug to stroke patients, said that some of these drug trials don't make sense for India. What did he mean by that?
Well, what he meant is that the particular town where he works is known as Sevagram. It's a very small, a rural, and a poor town. Many people are illiterate. They mostly work in the fields. And the two leading causes of death are snake bite and insecticide poisoning. And it's not a place where people are extremely concerned with reducing the chance of a second stroke once they've had a first one by a few percent, especially when the drug is very expensive. So that's the kind of example of a trial where people would really be benefited if they could come up with trials for some of the more endemic diseases there, or even just for something like cancer. But this kind of thing, it's really suited to a Western population, which has a lot of money to spend on improving their, you know, their chances of not having a second stroke by just a tiny bit.
I read in your article that the Indian government last year scrapped a law that prevented companies from testing drugs there if the drug had not been proven safe in trials in their country of origin. Why did they do that? Why is India eager to bring in these trials?
It brings in money, for one. It brings in sometimes equipment. And the idea is that it brings in expertise and business, that people will be trained in proper clinical procedure. It's quite valuable for a country that's trying to develop in this area.
Jennifer Kahn is a contributing editor for Wired Magazine. Stay with us. There is more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced.
Given day in Boston, there are more than 6,000 people living on the street, and for much of the day, they're on their feet. For the homeless, the frigid winters in the Northeast can mean frostbite and other medical problems. Since 1997, the group Healthcare for the Homeless has run The Foot Room at the St. Francis Shelter in Boston. It's a sanctuary for homeless men and women to get a foot soak, a medical checkup, and some tender care that starts at the bottom. Producer Rachel Gottbaum recently visited the Foot Room.
Okay. Are you coming in, sir? Okay. Okay, I have a chair right here. Oh, yeah. Come on down.
Okay. My name is Cecilia Ibiabuchi. I am the clinic manager. Originally, I'm from Africa, Nigeria.
Now, why feet? I mean, I don't normally think about feet, but why feet? What's going on here with the feet?
I'm glad you asked me that question, because most people cannot understand why feet is a problem. And today I have a typical example of why feet is a problem.
You want to show me?
Yes.
Talk? Sir, what is your name?
Sean Williams.
Have you been here before?
No, it's my first time.
Why did you come here?
I have blisters on my feet from shoes being too small, and I heard this was like the best place for homeless people to come to get their feet checked out.
How does it feel? You're soaking right now. How does it feel?
It's very good. They did a good job with the temperature of the water. My feet are very cozy right now.
And where do you usually hang out?
It's usually down in Pine Street or the Corner Mall in downtown, you know, doing odd jobs, deliveries and stuff. So,
how long have you been soaking?
I've been here for about three minutes and like 22 seconds.
Hi, how are you?
I'm Leanna. I'm from Roxbury Community College, and I'm a nursing student. So you take blood pressure first?
Yeah, we take blood pressures and the temperatures and just check their heart rate just to make sure they're okay. There you go, 96.3. Well, after we take their vital signs, we're just going to set them up, examine their feet. We're going to let them soak it for a while, get them to some new socks.
Why do you think feet are important?
Feet are very important. You have to take care of them. If you don't take care of them, you know, you can get all these types of sores and infections, and it can lead to, like in a lot of diabetic patients, their feet being amputated just for not having good foot care.
What's going on here is we have my friend here who the sneakers he has on were too tight for his feet.
But he's got a big...
an echo-sized blister.
Okay.
And that is open. I'm going to wipe the area gently.
Sounds like you need new sneakers to me.
I wear 13, but I had a 12 on for about 2 months.
Can you guys help me?
Do you want to
set him up? Chalk?
No.
Please, thank you. Let me just give him a note to go to Claudine and get some sneakers. St. Francis House provide shoes for people, so I help to identify who has an emergency and needs footwear.
So we're going to try to get me a size 13 here, and hopefully they have it.
Hi, how are you?
Good morning.
What's your name?
Bill Foley.
Have you come here before, Bill?
All the time, at least once a week, the minimum.
When did you start coming here?
About 3 years ago.
Why?
My feet were bad. I almost had frostbite.
You almost had frostbite?
Well, it was the beginning stages of frostbite, yeah.
And how did you know?
I was walking funny, my feet were killing me, they were hurting, like walking on glass. they seen me and they said it was the beginning stages of frostbite. If I stayed on any longer, it would have been frostbite, and I would have probably lost some toes.
Now, how long have you lived outside?
Off and on for the past 10 years.
So you credit this place for saving your toes?
That's my mental health and my feet first, yeah. It just followed itself.
So feet first and then the rest?
All the way up the line.
So you're coming once a week to have them soaked?
Yep.
How are they feeling right now?
Nice and hot.
So where do you usually stay? You're staying at the Long Island shelter. Where else do you stay?
Outside a lot in the Commons a few times, on the beach in South Boston. Quincy in the woods, out in Quincy, Cambridge in the woods. Just pitch a tent somewhere, you know, small patch of woods somewhere. And throw a sleeping bag down, a tent over you, a blanket over you, whatever. And not out for the night. And hopefully nobody comes by during the night and try to rob you and hurt you. Yeah.
So just tell me your name.
Joel Russian, a.k.a. Slim Dog.
And how old are you, Slim Dog?
I'm 55 years old.
And where do you live?
Right now I'm living at the Veterans Shelter over on Court Street.
Why did you decide to have your feet cared for?
Because I'm a Vietnam veteran, and when I was in Vietnam, I caught something called jungle rot.
Jungle what?
Jungle rot.
Jungle rot, uh-huh.
Yes. It's like a bad form of athlete's foot, and it never totally went away.
And so what did you find here?
What I found here is I can get clean socks. And they give you cream, antifungal cream. They give you powder for your feet. And you soak your feet. And you just get some tender, loving care here. People just care about you and make you want to care about yourself. Because sometimes you do get just kind of hopeless sometimes.
If it's the only thing you can do to help somebody who is homeless, providing comfort to their feet, you don't know how much it means to me to do this. It makes me feel good, and it's very rewarding to my career.
Sean Williams here again.
So, Sean, you came back. Oh, my God. What am I looking at down there?
We're looking at a pair of brand-new Spalding, nice sports sneakers. These are perfect fit. It feels like I'm walking on cushion.
So what are you going to do about the socks?
I have to go look for the socks from the clothing department, so some big socks.
Are they Harvard socks?
Yes, donation.
So have you gotten Harvard socks before?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. We got some nice socks out here. I mean, they have some really good socks.
They got the H on them.
Yeah.
And the colors. Well, let's see if they work.
All right. Let's cross our fingers. Come on.
Ready?
Come on. Come on. Yes. Finally.
Looks like the Harvard socks. Yay.
Thank you, Jesus. It worked.
How does that sock feel?
Oh, it feels comfortable. It's nice, nice and warm.
Our piece was produced by Rachel Gottbaum. And now this news about New Orleans. A federal judge today shot down a lawsuit seeking to keep a cruise ship docked in New Orleans for temporary housing for Hurricane Katrina evacuees. The ruling about the Scotia Prince ship lets the Federal Emergency Management Agency close the book on its use of cruise ships as temporary housing in New Orleans. Residents of the ship wanted to stay there for several more months, but the judge said it was not the role of the courts to make decisions for federal agencies like FEMA. He did say, though, that he would monitor the situation to make sure that the agency kept its promise to provide shelter to those left homeless by the hurricane. Well, as always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your name and tell us the town you're from. You're listening to Here and Now.
The World Baseball Classic is now underway. Japan clobbered China 18-2 and South Korea blanked Taiwan 2-0 in the first two games of the first ever tournament, which were played in Tokyo. The first game for the U.S. team is Tuesday against Mexico in Phoenix. And joining us to discuss the World Baseball Classic and other sports news is Only a Game host Bill Littlefield. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you very much, Deb.
Well, do you think the World Baseball Classic is a good idea?
It's a fine idea. How can people playing baseball for their countries be a bad idea? I just think people have to recognize that it's not exactly the World Cup. We're talking here about an event that's presided over and was arranged by Major League Baseball primarily for its own purposes.
I read that new Yankee center fielder, Johnny Damon, said that the Classic is a chance to make baseball fans forget about steroids and maybe restore its reputation.
Well, I don't know how many baseball fans are really thinking about steroids in March. You know, they're mostly thinking about how well their home team is going to do once the season gets going. I certainly hope that nobody playing in the World Baseball Classic tests positive for anything, because that would throw a wrench into Mr. Damon's theory.
What about the possibility of players getting injured before the season even starts?
Baseball players historically have had remarkably creative ways to get injured. Sometimes they jump up when they're excited about a home run. They're sitting in the dugout. They jump up and crack their heads on the cement roof, and they're out for several weeks. Wade Boggs once injured himself pulling off a boot. He fell off his bed and hurt his back. So, I mean, to be injured playing baseball is fairly unusual, actually. It's usually something peripheral. I don't think that the owners and managers have to worry.
Are you eager to watch the games?
I would like to. I'd like to tune in from time to time. Of course, some of them are occurring in time zones, you know, far removed from our own. Right. But I will say this. If I were in Florida covering spring training this year, if I were in the Orlando vicinity, for example, I certainly would rather watch a World Baseball Classic game than the various meaningless exercises being perpetrated at spring training camps all around me.
Well, let's turn to a sport not in season, but it's still front page news, NFL football. Mm-hmm. Games at the bargaining table right now, really. What's going on in the labor dispute there, Bill?
Well, you and I don't have time to really discuss in any kind of detail what's going on. But basically, it's two groups of fairly wealthy men, actually one group of fairly wealthy men and one group of extremely wealthy men arguing about how big the pie is and how it should be distributed. Really, the most interesting thing about this dispute is that the owners want to limit the actual revenue that's being talked about as splittable with the players, and the players want a piece of everything the owners make, even the stuff that's only kind of tangentially connected to football games.
Hmm. Any chance this might alienate fans?
Well, you know, historically, fans say that they're alienated by disputes between labor and management, and then they flock back to the game at the first possible opportunity. So I don't really buy the idea that fans ever get mad enough to actually stop spending their money on the games.
It's a no risk to next season?
I don't know. Well, not certainly not to next season. The risk is somewhere down the road if they can't hammer something out that creates some sort of order in the game.
Right. And moving on, March Madness is almost upon us. The NCAA tournament brackets will be revealed the week from Sunday, mm-hmm. but this weekend there is one regular season game that's always a must-see for college basketball.
Saturday night, we've got Duke at North Carolina. Duke has only lost two games. Last I looked, North Carolina was 15th in the country, so that'll be great. And it's, of course, being played at Duke, so the requisite craziness will occur in the stands, including people painting themselves blue and falling all over each other and all the rest of it. So, yeah, everybody will be happy to see that.
And why are people so passionate about this rivalry, Bill?
Well, partly because Duke and North Carolina, UNC and Duke, are so close to each other, and they're 8 or 9 miles apart. The other is there is such a kind of a clear distinction between the two. You've got Duke, the private university, versus UNC, the state university. You've got UNC catering almost entirely to in-state folks, Duke catering very much to people coming down from New Jersey to spend 4 years being crazy over the basketball team and then returning to New York to make a lot of money.
Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. He joins us every so often to talk sports. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and now.
We'll be right back.
comics in show business, as well as one of its biggest enigmas. Although the first season episodes of Chappelle's Show on Comedy Central were among the best-selling TV to DVD releases in history, he walked away from filming the third season of that show and went to Africa. He left behind a $50 million deal and caused many in the industry to question whether he was physically or mentally ill. Now, he's back with a new film, Dave Chappelle's Block Party, a musical celebration with generous amounts of his comic audacity thrown in. Here and Now's pop culture critic Renee Graham talked with Robin Young about Dave Chappelle, both the man and his film. One warning, like the film, this conversation contains adult language. Renee reminds us about what made Dave Chappelle's Comedy Central show such a hit.
Nothing was ever off limits. You know, he would do these absolutely merciless imitations of R. Kelly and sort of riffing on R. Kelly's, you know, legal problems. And, you know, one of the extended skits that went over several episodes was these recollections by Charlie Murphy, who was a cast member on Chappelle's show and is also Eddie Murphy's brother, talking about hanging out with Eddie Murphy, meeting celebrities. And one of the celebrities he met was singer Rick James. And Dave Chappelle would imitate Rick James, who as just this, you know, coked out, womanizing monster who somehow justified everything he did by screaming, "I'm Rick James, bitch."
You know you was wrong for what you did to me earlier. Look what you did to my face. I'm sorry, Charlie Murphy. It was an accident. I was having too much fun. I'll offer you a truce. The stickiest of the icky. You want to smoke with the old boy, Rick James?
Yo, man, my forehead is bumping, man.
Now that you mention it, I think I'm bleeding inside my chest. But I got the mess. Bitch, come over here and have sex with Charlie Murphy. I'm Rick James, bitch.
I can almost say that, you know, that it was the idea of having to say "I'm Rick James, bitch" over and over again was part of what made him walk away. I think he started to feel very limited, and that the things that he might have been a throwaway line to him, but that the public would sort of glom onto, and then that's suddenly who he would become. And he didn't want, I don't think he wanted to be the "I'm Rick James, bitch" kind of guy. I think he knew he had more talent than that, and there was more he could do.
Well, and the irony is, Renee, that I think there are probably a lot of people listening who didn't have a clue who Dave Chappelle was until he walked away from the show. And then maybe they saw him on one of his high-profile appearances on Oprah or inside the Actors Studio.
But I think we should be clear. There was a gap. He sort of walked away and went to Africa, I think, in April of 2005. He didn't start making sort of bigger public appearances until January or February. So there was a good gap there. He was doing a little, you know, stand-up bits here and there. But for the most part, he's kept his head pretty low for about 8 months.
Well, he talked about why he took so much time off with James Lipton on that Inside the Actors Studio. We have a clip. Let's listen.
I was freaked out, man, with the fame thing and being called crazy and drug addict and all these things. Scared me. You know, being treated that way. Like, I'm not a person anymore.
Some say that Inside the Actor's Studio is just one of the most riveting pieces of television they've ever seen because he was so real.
It really was. It was incredibly compelling. I mean, he was there, and you got this sense of, you know, he was funny, but he also really spoke about, and he got across how disenchanted he's become and how difficult he found this sort of swell of success he suddenly experienced, because he'd been around such a long time. And I think when he began doing his show on Comedy Central, he was just this, you know, this comedian who liked telling jokes and wanted to do a little show, and suddenly it became the biggest thing since sliced bread, and he was the heir apparent to Richard Pryor. And I think all of that became more than he was really ready to handle.
Well, and now he's got a new film out, Dave Chappelle's Block Party. Block Party centers around an actual free live show on the streets of Brooklyn. And it's something that Chappelle, it was his sort of gift.
You know, the way he puts it in the film is that he's putting on the concert he always wanted to see. And it's interesting, the people who really first discovered him through Chappelle's show might be a little put off, but then again, those who enjoyed Chappelle's show because of the musical acts he featured every week, I think are really going to get into this film because it's a wonderful concert film.
Yeah, the musical roster features Kanye West, Erykah Badu, and a reunion of the Fugees. Let's remind ourselves of their sound. Here they are doing Killing Me Softly.
Hey, yo, Al, you know you got the lyrics.
I heard he sang a good song. I heard he had a style. And so I came to see him and listen for a while.
The Fugees were one of the biggest hip-hop acts of the 1990s, and then Lauryn Hill, of course, then went on and had her huge solo album, The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, which became the first hip-hop album to win a Best Album Grammy. It's such a remarkable moment. I mean, if you know, for a hip-hop fan in the 1990s, this would be like, you know, it's like the Beatles getting back together. You never thought it would be possible. You knew every time you know, there was sniping on records, there was sniping interviews between the three members, and suddenly here they are again and sounding and looking really good.
What are some of the less well-known acts featured in the film?
Well, that I think one of the interesting things in the film is, you know, Dave Chappelle is a really well-known performer these days. He could have gotten 50 Cent and Mary J. Blige, but this is really about music he likes. And so he has, you know, Jill Scott, who's this wonderful soul singer who's been around for the last few years. He has hip-hop groups like The Roots and especially Dead Prez, who, you know, are critically acclaimed, an underground sensation, but do not get radio airplay. And to see Dead Prez in a major motion picture, it's a pretty extraordinary thing. I think it says a lot about Dave Chappelle and what's important to him. And it don't stop till we get them crackers on the block. They call it
But Renee, how is it more than a music film? I mean, what are the storylines?
As the film begins, Dave Chappelle is in Ohio, where he now lives and was and spent part of his childhood, and he's literally walking around town inviting people to come to this block party in Brooklyn. And, you know, it's young black guys, it's old white women, and in one case, he wanders up and just happens to see the marching band for Central State University, a small school in Ohio, and as we'll hear in this next clip, he invites them to play at his block party.
The whole band?
Yeah, two buses, right?
Yeah.
It's not going to be more than two buses, is it?
No, it won't be more than two buses.
Yeah, man, come on, rep yeah. Southwest Ohio,
yes,
man.
We would.
You'll do it?
Yes, we would.
You said compensation what?
Compensation? It comes with a sandwich.
Would it be snacks?
Oh, there'll be snacks. Don't we got snacks in the budget?
This film is, well, it's sounding more like a documentary.
You know, if you had it categorized, I suppose documentary wouldn't be necessarily wrong, but it reminds me more of the film Wattstacks from 1973, which was sort of the black Woodstock. And it had the big, you know, some of the big African-American acts at the time, like Isaac Hayes and the Staple Singers. This is the same thing. There's a very loose, positive vibe. It's fun. The acts are really good, and in between the acts, Dave Chappelle comes on stage, and he kind of riffs on the audience. He riffs on the fact that it's raining.
Rain. The crowd, everybody's welcome.
And the audience is just eating it up because it's a free show and it's a really good free show.
Is it a good movie?
It is a good movie. It's not music everyone will enjoy. It's not necessarily humor everyone will get. And I think that's also the thing. He's not trying to appeal to everyone. And there are jokes he makes that, you know, if you get them, they're really, really funny. If you don't get them, you might scratch your head. But I think there will still be something there people can enjoy.
That's Here and Now pop culture critic Renee Graham. Dave Chappelle's Block Party opens in theaters today.
I'm going to take it slow.
That's You Got Me by The Roots, featuring Erykah Badu and Jill Scott. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Deborah Becker. Join us next time for the news and these stories.